Does anyone have any more questions or comments about the practice from today that they would like to bring up now?
I have a quick one. It's not only about, it's not exactly for today, but in general. If sometimes we are in an environment where there is, let's say, some noise or something that bothers us, can we use earplugs?
Why not?
I don't know, because sometimes with earplugs you can hear a lot what's happening within you, and I was thinking maybe for Vipassana this would be good, because you can kind of hear more of what's happening, and it could be disturbing, but in general, can this create headache, or does it have any side effects? Because, for example, sometimes it could be really noisy, not here, but somewhere else, or sometimes there are specific noise. For example, there is a ticking clock, I better finish the retreat now, because I'm going to go crazy. So then the only thing which would save me from that would be either removing the clock or the sound that is kind of repeated, or...
Okay. Of course, in general, particularly for shamatha practice, we want to try to find a location that has minimal amount of noise, because noise is really quite a strong distraction. So in general, we should try to find a place where we have least amount of noise to practice. That's why, you know, if we're practicing at home, it's good to practice early in the morning, because usually it's most quiet where we are. So that's the first point, is to really try to find a place with less noise. The less noise, the better. Secondly, though, we need to be careful we don't get into having aversion to noise. Because the reality is, unless you're in a soundproof room, there will always be some sort of noise. You know, there will be some ambient noise, even minimal noise. So we need to be careful that we don't get into, oh, there's a ticking clock again, you know, or there's, oh, those birds, they're so loud, you know, so noisy, those birds, wish they'd be quiet. So we need to be careful we don't get into this aversion, because otherwise you'll get so frustrated, because there will always be at some time some sort of ambient noise somewhere. And so we need to not get into that habit of having an aversion to the sound. And so what we can do is, to help with that is, if you're in a place, and let's say you're at home and meditating, you're normal, it's normally quite quiet, but on this particular day the neighbour decides to do some hammering or something and sounds like they're going to be going for a while. Of course, if it's completely super loud so it's hurting your ears, you may want to meditate. But what we can do in those occasions, of course, is actually switch to using the sound as the object for the meditation. You know, maybe the neighbor's got the washing machine going right when we're meditating, you know, really quite noisy. So if we can't, of course, in general, just let go of any distractions, noise, and come back. But if it's really quite overwhelming, we don't want to get into this like, oh, that noise, go away, because then we're really, it's going to make much worse. Rather, make friends with the noise and switch. And if it's a repetitive noise that seems like it's going to go on for quite some time, we got two options: either just stop meditating, or we can switch to using the sound as the object of shamatha practice for the rest of that session.
So instead of breath, the repetitive sound, we concentrate on it.
Yeah,
and it's the same.
Yeah, and so you can then make use of that. You know, if it's overwhelming, if it's not, then just let it go and come back. But if it's overwhelming, and then we can just use the sound as the object for that rest of that session. In that way, we've got a shamatha session with mindfulness, and we're getting in the habit of not having aversion to sound, which means that in future, if a sound comes up, it won't really annoy us so much. And then we can really just let it go and come back.
Because I have only aversion towards really repetitive noise, not towards, let's say, birds or this and that, but if something is like...
Sure.
So earplugs, never.
Oh, so yeah, there's no. So actually, I think Alan Wallace does this as well, but I certainly do, is when I'm travelling, you know, on planes and trains and that, I actually have noise-cancelling headphones.
Yeah.
You know, and I bought the top-of-the-range Bose ones. And they really are great. So if you're really in a noisy environment, then why not? You know, if you're like, you know, traveling or something and there's a lot of noise and you want to meditate, put the noise cancelling headphones on and...
Or earplugs.
Yeah, I mean, I think noise cancelling headphones are much better because they really do cancel out the noise really well. And then you don't have to be sticking things inside your ear for that. So I use it, and I think Alan Wallace actually uses them as well when he's like traveling and stuff. So I think they're great, fantastic.
Thank you.
Okay, anything else?
I would need some advice because now my mind has some new fantasy that when these different pictures, memories, whatever is coming, then I see it clear, I want to observe, but the moment I want to observe it, it's labeling it. It's like in a quiz show. I see here is ice cream, and then it says ice. And then I see a friend, Karin. And it's the whole time like this. It's something, it's maybe a very complicated picture. I can observe and there is no labeling.
Yeah. So, again, as a beginner, I wouldn't get too worried about labeling because actually the labeling can help you to avoid getting caught up in it. So, actually, labeling can be useful to avoid getting caught up, because if you're labeling it, you're seeing it as an object and not in, if you're caught up in it, you can't label because you're right in the middle of it. So I wouldn't worry too much about it, but try and let go of that as much as possible, particularly if it starts becoming commentary, you know, then just gently let that go as much as possible. And then over time, you'll find that it'll be less and less and less. So I wouldn't worry too much about it.
How can I let go? It's just there in the moment I want to observe. Then I observe the labeling and then the next picture is coming. So I'm not really sure right now how I can let it go.
The
labeling go, that it's just there.
Again, I wouldn't worry too much about because that's our habit to do these sorts of things. So, I mean, I wouldn't sort of get frustrated or push or force or something. It's just notice it and as much as possible just let it go. That's all. I mean, it's just habit. It's just habit. You're just training and it'll slowly become less and less and less. And patience, yes. Patience is very important in this practice and all practices. Yeah.
Well, I have a question related to stages as well as today's practice, so can I ask it now?
Sure. Yeah, sure.
Yeah. I mean, it's about very early stages.
Sure, sure.
Well, I added the practice of setting the mind in its natural state because I was stuck with the breathing meditation. And I thought it would spice up the practice a bit. And also Alan Wallace, on one hand here, he says that one should only add it after stage 3-4. But in other places, he says one can even take it
sure.
at the beginning.
Sure.
So I felt encouraged. I added it. But today I had this concern that maybe it's counterproductive because when I'm observing the mind, it's really difficult to get to let go of the breath. It's always there. Because for such a long time, I've tried so hard to hold on to the breath. I've conditioned myself to hold on to the breath. And finally now I'm holding on to it. So now there is this practice where I should actually let it go. So it's kind of a bit contradictory. And I'm afraid that by practicing this second mind in a central state, I will actually counter sort of...
Well,
I don't think
you'll counteract, but because, I mean, all of these practices, whether they're the breath or settling the mind or an image of a Buddha, we're strengthening our faculty of mindfulness. So regardless of what the object is, we are improving mindfulness. So we're not sort of working against the practice. But as you said, maybe you have that strong habit of automatically focusing on the nostrils. And so when you're looking at the mind, you may go there. But actually, in the beginning phases of looking at the mind, that's maybe not such a bad thing, because then it's an anchor. It anchors you. Well, if you then continue to simply use the mind as the object and you stay with that, then over time you will become more familiar with focusing on the mind and you'll find naturally the breath will be less and less and less and you'll need less and less of an anchor. So actually it's not a bad thing. Yeah, patience.
What is your experience? When is it actually... I mean, is it okay to add this practice at the very early stage? Like, I'm not even in stage 3, I'm kind of a threshold. But
no, I mean, in Alan's book, you know, he he mentions a couple of possibilities, and he also says there that, you know, that the settling the mind or even the awareness of awareness could be optimal from the very beginning for certain people. So, you know, if you're strongly drawn to that practice, then even if you find the settling the mind quite difficult, but you see the benefits and you're enthusiastic about it. See, this is the key, is the enthusiasm. If you're not enthusiastic about the practice and it's difficult, I don't think it's going to work, you know. But even if it's difficult, like the many people find the settling the mind quite difficult because it's quite subtle and they're not used to it, but if you really see a lot of benefit for yourself and you're enthusiastic about it, then of course that enthusiasm can motivate us to go through the early stages where it's quite difficult and we can progress. So that's sort of I think the key there is that enthusiasm. And if we've got that and we really want to do it, then we can do it from the beginning, or we could use, as you a little bit suggested, use the breath as a bit of an anchor point and still do the mind practice from the beginning as the main practice and have the breath as a bit of an anchor to help us through the early stages. To start immediately with
focusing on the mind, and make sure first you meditate for about 10 minutes, make sure you're really calm, and then focus on the mind.
Well, of course, we need to do the preparation, you know, preparing body, speech, mind. So however long that takes you, it depends how quickly you can settle the body and the mind. But once you've settled the body and the mind, then, of course, you can go straight into the mind practice. Or if you find that doing 5 minutes of breath work or something is really helpful in preparing for that, then you could do that as well. So there's no...
Depends.
How it feels. Yeah, sure. Okay, let's go back now to the shamatha chart. So we're going very well in our shamatha practice because over the last 2 days we've managed to get to stage 4. The first day, a little bit difficult. The first day at stage 1 we were struggling a bit. We could only hold the object for maybe a couple of seconds and then we were distracted most of the time. But then even on the first day we persevered, put more effort in, and we got to stage 2. This continuous setting. So by the end of that first day there, we could actually hold the object for a minute or two, but then we still got distracted quite a lot and for longer periods of time. But then yesterday we made big progress in our shamatha practice. Our mindfulness really improved a lot yesterday. In the early stages yesterday, in stage 3, in resetting, our mindfulness was getting quite good, so we could hold the object for up to 5 to 10 minutes, and then when we got distracted, we very quickly came back to the object. And then we continued to improve our mindfulness throughout the day, and by the end of the day, we got to stage 4, close setting. So now we can hold the object for the whole period, the whole meditative period, and of course also yesterday we could extend our meditation sessions up to nearly an hour or so we could meditate for a whole hour and hold the object for the whole hour and never lose it once. So that was stage 4. But of course, we still have a lot of work to do on the quality of our holding, because still there's a lot of background noise and static that is sort of interfering with the clarity of attention, even though we never really lose the object. So today we're going to go further in the shamatha path. We're going to go for stage 6, 5, 6, and maybe even 7. Let's see how we go. So stage 5 and 6 we see on the next road. This is called the power of introspection, this road. So now our introspection is really getting quite good, and we see that the hook is more prominent on stage 5 and 6. And so early on, in the first couple of stages, introspection was really just noticing if we were completely distracted or half asleep. But by stage 4 now, and we're coming on to stage 5 and 6, Now we can hold the object the entire period without ever completely losing it. So now we're really starting to overcome the very heavy distraction and dullness. But we still have a lot of work to do on the quality of our holding. And often here it is, if we're too tight in our focus, we get really agitated. And if we're too loose or too relaxed, we become dull. So we need to have that balance between being too tight and too loose. And here, often the analogy in the meditation texts is the analogy of a guitar string. If a guitar string is too tight or too loose, it doesn't play well. Likewise, if our mind is too tight or too loose, it doesn't focus well. So we need to fine-tune that focus. So here over these stages 5, 6, and 7, we are fine-tuning our focus, overcoming more and more subtle levels of agitation and subtle dullness. So let's have a look. So this is over stage 5 and 6. And then so we see by stage 6, now we've said goodbye to the rabbit has disappeared. So subtle dullness is not really a big problem anymore. And then we see also there at stage 7, we're saying goodbye to the monkey. So that's the agitation or discursive thought. And the elephant has hardly any black left on the back of the elephant. So by stage 7 now, we are really starting to meditate an entire session without really much of even hardly a hint of subtle dullness or subtle agitation. And by stage 7, if we notice any subtle dullness or subtle agitation, we can quickly dispel it. So let's have a look now at these three stages a little bit more in Alan Wallace's book, a few more things to talk about. So first, stage 5, which here is called disciplining. This is on page 77. He says the following. Through the skillful, sustained practice of settling the mind in its natural state. So again, here in his book, he's using this model where he talks about using the breath for the first 4 stages, then settling the mind for the next 3 stages, and then the awareness of awareness for the final 2 stages. But that doesn't mean, of course, that we need to follow that strategy. So we could use the breath the whole way, settling the mind the whole way, or even the awareness of awareness from the very beginning the whole way. Eventually you will achieve the 5th attentional stage called tamed attention. That's how he translates it. At this point, you find that you can take satisfaction in your practice, even though there is still some resistance to it. You have progressed well on this path, and the results of your efforts are apparent to you. Involuntary thoughts continue to arise, but instead of their tumultuous outpouring like a cascading waterfall, they now flow like a river moving smoothly through a gorge. So remember, we had that other model that's often used when we use the mind as the object instead of using the 9 stages. We had that 4-stage model, the waterfall, then the fast-flowing river, slow-moving river, and then the still lake. So he's sort of using that model here because he's talking about settling the mind practice. But that sort of correlates with the 5th stage roughly. As you progress from the 4th to the 5th stage of attentional training, you are presented with one of the greatest challenges on the entire path to shamatha. Free of coarse excitation, you must now confront another problem that was lurking in the shadows of your mind all along, coarse laxity. As mentioned earlier, the symptom of this attentional disorder is that your attention succumbs to dullness, which causes it to largely disengage from its meditative object. The Tibetan word for laxity has the connotation of sinking. It's as if the attention, instead of rising to the object, sinks down from it into the recesses of the mind. The attention fades, as it were, but instead of fading out, it is more like fading in, stepping onto a slippery slope that leads down to sluggishness, lethargy, and finally sleep. This is a peaceful state of mind, so the ignorant may mistake it for the attainment of shamatha, which literally means quiescence, tranquility, and serenity. True shamatha is imbued not only with a degree of stability far beyond that achieved at this stage of attentional practice, but also with an extraordinary vividness that one has hardly begun to develop at this point in the training. And then a little bit more on page 78 in the middle. The primary challenge here is to overcome laxity without undermining stability. The way to counteract laxity is to arouse the attention, to take a greater interest in the object of meditation. Tibetan contemplatives liken this to stringing a lute. If the strings are too taut, they may easily break under the strain. But if they are too slack, the instrument is unplayable. Likewise, the task at this point is to determine the proper pitch of attention. If you arouse the mind too much in your efforts to remedy laxity, it will easily fall into excitation. But if you relax too much, you will likely succumb to laxity. It's a delicate balancing act, and the only way you can meet this challenge is through your own experience, determining for yourself the suitable degree of effort to tune your attention. Buddhist contemplatives have grappled with this dilemma for millennia, and they report that it takes great skill to solve it. Having achieved the third and fourth stages with the power of mindfulness, the fifth stage is achieved by the power of introspection. The power of introspection is the faculty of monitoring the quality of your attention, and this skill must now be honed, so that you can detect more and more subtle degrees of laxity and excitation. And then moving on to stage six is on page 99. As you continue in full-time practice of shamatha, after some thousands of hours of rigorous training, you will reach the sixth attentional stage, known as pacified attention. This is achieved by the power of introspection, and by now you no longer experience resistance to the training. You must still be on guard against the occurrence of medium laxity, in which you are aware of the object of mindfulness, but it is not vivid, not very vivid. In addition, you are now prone to and need to be able to detect subtle excitation, in which the meditative object remains at the center of attention, but involuntary thoughts emerge at the periphery. Returning to our earlier metaphor of listening to the radio, this is like being tuned in to the desired station, but faintly hearing another station or simply static at the same time. The quality of attention you are seeking here is like a clear channel, unsullied with extraneous noise. In stage six, involuntary thoughts pass through your consciousness like a river slowly flowing through a valley. So there we see the third stage of that other analogy. As the mind becomes more at ease, thoughts flicker like butterflies through the space of awareness, and you are able to passively witness the entire sequence of thoughts arising, playing themselves out, then vanishing. They seem to be less weighty, in that they are less able to pull your attention after them. Like Einstein's theory that physical space is warped by bodies of matter within it, it sometimes feels as if the space of awareness is warped by the contents of the mind. At times, when we become fixated on something, our minds seem to become very small. Trivial issues loom up in our awareness as if they were very large and important. In reality, they haven't become large, our minds have become small. The experienced magnitude of the contents of the mind is relative to the spaciousness of the mind. So to keep the activities of mind in perspective, let the space of awareness remain as expansive as possible. In the meantime, the less you grasp onto mental events, the less the space of the mind contracts around them and is warped by them. And then if we move on to stage 7, so here at stage 7, of course, we're moving on to the next road. This is the power of effort, or and here by effort we mean enthusiastic effort, enthusiasm. In fact, by stage 7 and 8, now our practice really starts to become effortless. So let's have a look at what happens. And by stage 7 and 8, now we can meditate for a few hours at a time, no problems. So we're doing very well in our shamatha. We're improving very quickly. So page 117. Once you have met the challenges of the first 6 stages of attentional development, you ascend to the 7th, which is called fully pacified attention. Asanga, again, Asanga was a great Indian master from the 5th century. He says, Asanga succinctly characterizes this stage of development with the statement, attachment, melancholy, and so on are pacified as they arise. Such experiences may continue to occur from time to time, but they have lost their power to disturb the equilibrium of your mind. Involuntary thoughts continue to course through the mind like a river slowly flowing through a valley, but as your mind settles more and more deeply in its natural state, there is nothing for them to attach to. In the absence of grasping, you are not attached to them, and they have no power in themselves to afflict you. The power by which the 7th stage is achieved is enthusiasm. The practice itself now fills you with joy. It is this that motivates you to continue in the practice, meeting the increasingly subtle challenges ahead. Having overcome the medium degree of laxity, subtle laxity remains, in which the object of mindfulness appears vividly, but your attention is slightly slack. No one but a highly advanced meditator is even capable of recognizing such a subtle degree of laxity. It is detected only in relation to the exceptionally high degree of vividness of which the trained mind is capable. Subtle excitation also occurs from time to time. As recommended previously, when laxity sets in, you arouse your attention. And when excitation occurs, you loosen up slightly. At the 7th stage, these subtle attentional imbalances are swiftly recognized due to your finely honed faculty of introspection, and they are easily remedied. The Tibetan word gom, usually translated as meditation, has the connotation of familiarity, and that is the quality of your experience at the stage of fully pacified attention. You have become highly adept at balancing and refining your attention, and the rest of the journey to the realization of shamatha is all downhill. There we go. We're on all downhill to shamatha. Good. Any questions about any of those 3 stages? Yeah.
I would like to ask if there's anything written about what happens on the body level of as the practice as well. There must be some.
Yes. Usually, of course, in meditation texts, there's not much talk about the body, apart from at a very basic level, you know, to have proper diet and those sorts of things. Of course, when we start to talk in the area of Tantra, where we talk about subtle mind and subtle body, then there's a lot of talk about subtle energies and chakras and so forth. But, of course, here, this shamatha practice is not presented in the context of Tantra. So here we don't even really have so much of a discussion about subtle energies. But certainly what we're going to see tomorrow when we look at the last 3 stages, particularly when we achieve shamatha, there is a radical transition in the body, particularly in the subtle energies in the body. So there's a very clear description of that that we're going to look at tomorrow evening. But in general, you know, we talked about the first fault of laziness, and we had those antidotes of faith, aspiration, effort, and pliancy. So pliancy is this flexibility and serviceability of body and mind. And so as we progress in this path of shamatha, not only will our mind become more flexible and serviceable, so will our body in general. So we'll have less problems with the body the further we go in the practice. And there is what's called this physical pliancy, which we actually achieve when we achieve shamatha. And there's a very clear description about that that we're going to look at tomorrow evening in the context of shamatha. Okay.
Related to the earlier, are there, because there have been many research, academic research done in meditation and how it affects brain. So, are there any research done with the meditation of samatha?
Yes, in fact, they did, Alan Wallace actually was instrumental in that research. It was, I think, already maybe 10 years ago. It was called the Shamatha Project, where they had quite a number of meditators together, I think, for two groups of 6 months each. And they had them there with hooked up, and they were taking blood samples, and they were doing all sorts of things. And they did quite extensive medical tests on them. And as a result of that, I think a couple of scientific papers have actually come out from that, and I think there is still more, because they had enormous amount of data, and I think there's still, some of it is still being analysed today. So yes, there has been some from that project, and I think now there are a lot of other projects coming out in that regard, because, you know, now mindfulness is a very, very popular thing, and so now I think there's more and more money available in the scientific community to do these sorts of studies, because, you know, the corporate world or the they can see that they can benefit from this, so they're willing to put money in now. So, in fact, I think it's one of the top areas of research now is in mindfulness. And of course, that's something that Alan Wallace is continuing to emphasize. And, you know, he's trying to put together these sort of retreat places called contemplative observatories, where people can go to do long-term retreat. And he's also trying, as part of that, to have some integration into the scientific community, so the scientific community can also study long-term meditators, particularly people who are doing long-term shamatha retreat. So that's also something that he's pursuing.
What would a long-term shamatha retreat mean?
For us as a beginner, probably about 3 days. because, I mean, of course, as a beginner, it's much easier to do this sort of group retreat because it's led and you have the group energy. You know, as a beginner, when we try to do a solitary retreat, even for 2 or 3 days, it can be quite challenging because we have to motivate ourselves and discipline ourselves, and of course, you know, we have to deal with our own mind and all these things. So, you know, even a few days can seem quite a long time as a beginner. But of course, then we become more and more familiar, and we can start to extend these retreats from a few days to a week to a month, a few months, a year, and so forth. So, of course, in the Tibetan tradition, you know, often there is this sort of tradition of doing these 3-year retreats, but mostly in the Tibetan tradition they're not shamatha retreats. But some people who do shamatha retreats, and I think Alan Wallace has a number of students who have been a number of years in retreat doing shamatha. So, I mean, it really depends on us as an individual, you know, what our aspirations are and what our life style can permit and so forth. And of course, there's no, unfortunately, what sometimes people think is that, oh, okay, long retreat, that'll fix everything, so I'll just give up everything and I'll go off and meditate for the next 3 years, you know. Maybe for some people that's a good thing to do, but we, of course, we need to be prepared and ready and so forth. It's not like if we just all jump off into doing a long retreat, that's going to fix everything. I mean, often what happens is people run back out after a week or two because they're not ready for that, you know. So there's a time and place for those longer retreats. And it may be that us as an individual, that maybe we never end up in the situation where we would want to do a year or two or 3 years. But that's okay. I mean, we all have our own particular aspirations and abilities and lifestyle, and so we work with that, you know. And we need that balance, of course, between retreat and then being out in the world, you know. We're not going to just achieve enlightenment by, you know, sitting in a cave for the rest of our life. We have to have that balance. And so that's why it's very helpful, important to have a really qualified teacher who can help strike that balance for us, you know, to know when it's time to do some retreat, when it's time to go out in the world, you know, to have this, and what sort of retreat, this sort of balance. It's not so easy to know from our own experience, unless we're already quite advanced, how to strike that balance. But that's what we can do, try and strike that balance. And of course, any effort we put into this practice, even if we can't do a long retreat, will give us beneficial results. You know, particularly once we start looking at the last few stages tomorrow night, we get to realize that actually to achieve shamatha requires a lot of sustained effort. And then we go, well, oh, that's just impossible for me, you know. I don't have that ability or time, so let's just forget about shamatha. I think this would be a big mistake, because even if we put a little bit of effort into this practice, and even if we manage just to get to stage two or stage three, already our attention skills are hugely improved on what they are now, and we'll already start to see a lot of positive benefits in our life, even if we can make a little bit of progress here. So whatever progress we can make is just going to give us that reward. So then we just do the best we can and then be happy with that.
As you were talking about tantric things, is it important for a tantric practitioner to achieve shamatha? Yeah.
Absolutely. And often in tantra, the shamatha practice takes on a different form, in terms of often that's done in conjunction with the what's called generation stage practice, a sadhana practice. And, you know, often you hear about, you know, they talk about these, you know, channels and chakras and so forth. And, you know, in tantric Buddhism, of course, you know, we talk about the deity and the mandala. You know, the mandala is the pure realm of a deity, which usually, if you've ever seen one, is very hugely elaborate, like super complex. And we're supposed to visualize this in our practice. But then often when it comes to the shamatha practice, and we, you know, we visualize this in a large form, but when it comes to shamatha practice, often there it's said that we are to visualize this huge complex mandala the size of a pea in like the navel chakra. That's the object of shamatha practice. So discursive thought. Yeah, I mean, of course, as a beginner, we need to have a bit of commentary to remind ourselves to do this. But then, of course, the introspection becomes more automatic. You know, it's the same as like driving, learning to drive a car. We have to use some commentary. You know, I have to look here, I have to press this, I have to do this, and we have to remind ourselves to do this. But then, of course, it becomes automatic. And then, so then, as the mindfulness improves, the introspection improves, and then it becomes an automatic thing without this sort of little bit of commentary to remind ourselves, oh, now check this, now do that. That sort of drops away over time. Yeah, I mean, of course, as a beginner, part of that introspection is, oh, now I better check my posture. Now I do this. Oh, I'm breathing out. Now I do that. But that's okay. They're reminders. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Slightly related to that question. In non-Buddha, like more advanced meditation, self-inspection? Are they distinctly two very separate things?
I'm not sure exactly the question. So the question is, what's the difference between maha mudra and...
Observing the mind in its natural state.
Right.
That sort of meditation and vipassana meditation where you're sort of exploring the nature of the mind. And are the two closely linked?
Yes. Yes. I mean...
Or are they distinctly separate?
Both. I mean... Of course, in the Vipassana practice, if we're doing a Mahamudra approach and we're looking at the mind, we are investigating. We can investigate the mind itself, or we can investigate the appearances to the mind and the nature of them. You know, like what is the nature of the mind, and what is the nature of these thoughts? Where are the thoughts coming from? Where are they going? Where are they abiding? So. When we do the shamatha, of course, we're not consciously doing this sort of investigation. But if we're very intuitive, simply doing the shamatha practice can sometimes lead to some insight. You know, these sorts of insights become very obvious without really consciously going into a Vipassana style practice. That's why another one of the advantages of this settling the mind in its natural state and the awareness of awareness practice, they can lead to some insights into the nature of the mind and nature of thoughts and so forth without really being a Vipassana practice. So therefore there is that sort of bridge into the Vipassana practice in that way. So that can happen often. Yeah, I mean, yeah, sure. But what we're not doing in this practice is consciously doing all this investigation. But if some insight comes, then great, it's good. Okay, then let's go back into the Shavasana to finish the day. Allowing your awareness to descend into the body. Simply becoming aware of sensations throughout the body. Using the out-breath to relax and release any tightness or tension in any part of the body. The mouth and jaw soft and relaxed. And all the muscles around the eyes soft and relaxed. this way, allowing the entire body to become completely relaxed, completely at ease. Relaxing more deeply with each out-breath. With each out-breath, letting go of any thoughts that may have arisen, happily releasing them. Allowing the mind to come to rest in the present moment. Through focusing on the sensations of the breath throughout the body. Maintaining that ongoing flow of mindfulness of the sensations of the breath throughout the entire cycle of each in and out breath. conclusion, we can dedicate the positive potential we've gathered from our time together here today towards the goal of cultivating a calm, clear, focused mind, towards the goal of becoming the masters of our mind instead of the slaves, and towards the goal of cultivating equanimity towards everyone around us. May all beings everywhere, plagued by sufferings of body and mind, obtain an ocean of happiness and joy by virtue of my merits. May no living creature suffer, commit evil, or ever fall ill. May no one be afraid or belittled with a mind weighed down by depression. May the blind see forms and the deaf hear sounds. May those whose bodies are worn with toil be restored on finding repose. May the naked find clothing, the hungry find food. May the thirsty find water and delicious drinks. May the poor find wealth, those weak with sorrow find joy. May the forlorn find hope, constant happiness and prosperity. May there be timely rains and bountiful harvests. May all medicines be effective and wholesome prayers bear fruit. May all who are sick and ill quickly be freed from their ailments. Whatever diseases there are in the world, may they never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid, and those bound be freed. May the powerless find power, and may people think of benefiting each other. For as long as space remains, for as long as sentient beings remain, until then, may I too remain to dispel the miseries of the world.